Hey, listeners, it's 2024, and we are so excited for everything ahead this year. If you haven't done so already, make sure to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get access to bonus episodes. We've already released 18 of them, and they come out twice a month. Plus, you can get access to ad-free episodes and our private Discord server to hang out with other members of the CashLack community. That's patreon.com/curbsiders. Paul, I'm going to start off by saying I hate this pun.
Great. Then okay. I'm sure I'll love it.
What did Mary Poppins sing to the child with diabetes?
A spoonful of insulin makes the sugar go down.
Yeah, pretty much. Just pretty much, yeah. Terrible. Surprise, audience. We need some more insulin puns, sugar puns. There's nothing good. There's nothing to pick
from. Would it surprise you to hear there's not a lot of glucometer puns out there? Because I looked and no. Slim pickings.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly CashLack Memorial Hospital and its affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frank Watto, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm good. And I'm good because tonight we have many times returning guest, Dr. Jeff Colburn, talking about continuous glucose meters, aka CGMs, and some patterns that you might see when looking at people's blood sugar readings and how to troubleshoot those patterns. So various patterns of hypo and hyperglycemia. And Paul, before we remind them who Jeff is, can you please tell them what is it that we do on Curbsiders?
Sure, Matt. We are the internal medicine podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. And Matt, why don't I let you tell us a little bit more about our guest and the practice-changing knowledge he imparted.
Okay, so Dr. Jeff Colburn is the director of the Diabetes Center at the Richmond Veterans Affairs Medical Center and serves as an associate professor of medicine for Virginia Commonwealth University. He has a passion for teaching medicine with an academic focus in areas like diabetes management and care delivered via virtual technologies. He is clinically active and teaches students, residents, and fellows in the inpatient and outpatient settings, which include a mixture of face-to-face and virtual encounters. I can say that I've known Jeff for 11 years now and have been a huge fan of him. He's taught me so much about diabetes and endocrinology in general. So very glad to have him back on the show. Before we get to the show, I should say that this and most episodes are available through VCU Health for CME at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And also, if you haven't signed up yet, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get twice monthly bonus episodes, ad-free episodes, and now access to Paul, our CashLack vault with over 400 show notes, figures, cover art, all our stuff, basically, Paul, is in there in a drive that people can get access to on the Patreon. So it's pretty cool.
Look smart on the words.
Look smart on the words. Jeff, welcome back to the show. So good to see you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been a bit.
Yeah, it has been a bit. I know you've moved jobs. You don't have to say where your new job is, but I hope things are going well. How's the move been?
Oh, good. I'm slowly working my way up towards taking over Paul's position. I'm in the Northeast now, so my secret assassin role has become within striking distance, so...
Jeff, you know we do this remotely. Like you don't have to move. You can just take my job. Like you don't have to put yourself through this, buddy. Like it's yours for the taking.
I'm overthinking this. I'm just trying to. Oh my gosh, I totally overthought
it's a Zoom
it.
Call.
I'm in you the same time zone though, so this makes life easier.
Yeah, that's. I think Paul last time he also threatened maybe to steal your cat because I think Ollie was recording with us and.
Well, I bought a dog now, and so I bought a protector, so you're going to have trouble getting in and getting her now, so.
Jeff, did you have, like, a book, movie, or TV show, something you want to recommend to the audience since you've answered all our standard questions many times already?
Oh, boy, let's see. I'm rereading a series that I had read a few years ago by an author named Stephen Saylor There are historical fiction set in Roman times. He's got several. They're very interesting. There's an intrigue with the character who's interacting with all of these big historical figures like Julius Caesar and tons of Roman folks that are of historical importance that I had never heard of before. But they're an interesting series of books, and that audio listening to them on my commute, and it's enjoyable.
Jeff, I hate to call you out like this. This is previous recommendation that you've already made, because I actually started reading the series.
Oh, dang.
Yeah. This is like a Roman detective, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. So I'm re-listening to them because I feel like I'm in this new job. And so I'm kind of like re-exploring some kind of thing again that I really enjoy. I don't know what it is, but I'm just listening to them again. There's like 15 of them. I just love them. Sorry, I keep that
record. Double recommend.
That's okay. Yeah. I recently reread like Dune, American Gods, like a couple of my old favorites that I just every once in a while like return to. I think it's just like watching. It's like watching a movie that you haven't seen in years. It's fine.
There's a plot twist that I totally forgot. So I'm like starting to question my own cognitive state. I'm like, oh, I should have remembered that plot twist. Oh, jeepers.
Caesar dies at the end?
Is that? Yeah, that one. Get stabbed.
All right. Well, Jeff, the impetus for this episode was, I guess our most recent episode with you was just talking all about insulin. And we talked about hypoglycemia. First of all, you mentioned on that episode, maybe doing an episode on insulin pattern matching, which is what we're going to be talking about later in this episode. But you also mentioned that there's been some changes around continuous glucose monitors. So let's start with a case, and then we'll talk about those a little bit first as a first part. So, Paul, do you want to read the case?
Sure, man. So we're going to tell you, Jeff, about Mr. H. He's a 58-year-old gentleman. He weighs 100 kilograms. He's got type 2 diabetes. He has obesity, hyperlipidemia, CKD3A without albuminuria. He takes insulin glargine 35 units nightly and metformin XR 750 2 tabs daily. His most recent A1C was 8.6. He doesn't really like finger sticks, but his fasting sugar is usually between 100 to 150 milligrams per deciliter when he checks, and he has not recorded nor does he report any lows. So we were talking about CGM and how this patient may benefit from it or may even want it. Seems like it might be a better option for him. But before we get into the granular details, could you just talk us through like bare basics? Like we were talking offline, you can't get too dumb for me in terms of continuous glucose monitors and sort of how you think about them, who gets them, what's available to us. So you can't start too simple. So just talk us through them and then we'll get more advanced from there.
Sure. So just thinking about this gentleman, you know, he's 58. So, I mean, age is relative, but I would just call him probably youngish. He is struggling with obesity. And so you want to try to prioritize medications that we might affect that well. And so those are options that we would want to consider for him. I often try to think about, you know, what's the A1C target for the patient? All of the diabetes guidelines have us think about the risks that we might impose on a patient by making the A1C, very like less than 7 for someone who's maybe more physiologically fragile, where that could be harmful by causing lows. And so this gentleman, he's got some CKD, but otherwise seems to be doing okay. I think we could probably seek an A1C target of, 6.5 to 7 would be reasonable. Try to get a little bit tighter. He's currently, like you'd mentioned, 8.6. So he's quite a bit above where we'd want. And like you'd mentioned, he's on basal insulin and metformin. So you're thinking about options. It seems like there's something discordant happening because his fasting sugar, like you'd mentioned, is 100 to 150. So one of the things that I teach trainees a lot is the A1C to finger stick correlation. A lot of times we talk to patients in A1Cs and they're used to looking at sugars. And so just the way I try to commonly relate this is in a blood sugar of 126 is equal to an A1C of 6. You have to know 126. That's the fasting sugar at which we diagnose diabetes. So it's just a good way to remember this 126 equals a 6. And then you just add 30 for every A1C point up. So 156 is a 7 and so on and so forth. 186 is an 8. So this gentleman at 8.6, you know, he's probably seeing blood sugars that are like around 200 on average. So that kind of makes us think, well, these fasting sugars don't make sense. And so either the A1C is discordant. We all did a talk on some of the A1C kind of pitfalls for why that falls apart. But we want to try to investigate his glucose otherwise and understand what's happening. And so to get into talking about continuous glucose monitors, you know, you could advise this person does finger sticks more. That might be where I start with this individual. He's on just once a day insulin. And so it could be reasonable that he does a couple of days of testings in that way. But it is exciting to now consider offering a person a CGM. There's two main kind of ways we can do that in an office setting. So you can do what's called a professional model or a CGM pro. That's one where the patient puts a sensor on, that it's put on in the clinic rather, and they'll usually wear it for 14 days and then they'll come back to the clinic. They can't see any of the sugars. It's just collecting the data. And then the office can download the sensor and look at the patterns of glucose. We think that that's safer for the beginning of some of these patients in that they can't react to glucose that they're not ready to understand and start treatments on. And this person is not on any treatments that he could titrate too much on his own, maybe the glargine a little bit. So that's kind of a pro version. And then what we're going to probably talk about mostly today is the personal use versions. These are ones that we prescribe to patients for them to have on their own. The main components of continuous glucose monitors are going to be the little piece that sticks to the patient called the sensor. And most of them now, the most upgraded versions, have integrated transmitters, meaning the Bluetooth signal that's sending the data to either their smartphone, or if they don't have a smartphone, a handheld reader. So the transmitter is included in the sensors nowadays. It used to be kind of two separate pieces a lot of the time. So you put this little sensor on their arm usually. It's about the size of, you know, two stat quarters or so. So, I mean, these are small nowadays. And you can beam those data to their phone continuously. That's the main setup. Did you have any questions or thoughts before I just continue on with some ideas?
So just to summarize, so the sensor is the thing that they stick to their skin that they wear around. Nowadays, a lot of them have a built-in transmitter, and then they can either use their phone to receive the signal, or if they don't have a smartphone, I guess there's some sort of handheld receiver that would get the data from the CGM.
You got it perfectly. And the handhelds have a little screen on there that basically shows the readout like your smartphone would show. If you're a person with a smartphone, there's no good reason to have to carry this extra device that you have to charge and then potentially also lose. Smartphone is, I think, the best way, to be honest, to go. And the added advantage is that the smartphones can upload to the cloud all of the data. So a clinic can download it from the cloud, or a family member can simultaneously and continuously follow a family member's sugar. So let's say you had a parent who you're worried about and has maybe some cognitive difficulty. As long as it's transmitting to their smartphone, the smartphone is going to be continuously with their cellular or Wi-Fi going up to the cloud. And that can go down to a son or daughter's phone constantly. And you can get alerts. So if they're having a high or low event, you can be alerted and take action. Same thing with a parent, with a child with diabetes. This is something that would be huge to make you feel comfortable.
Okay, so that makes me think, is it necessary? Should Paul and I be signing up for provider portals? I know there's two types of CGMs that I'm commonly seeing out there, two brands. So should we be signed up for the provider portal for both of them, and then we can somehow link to our patients in there?
Yeah, I would say probably the biggest hurdle right now is just workflows in clinics, getting the provider portal set up. It's probably a good idea if a clinic team wants to start using CGM in their practice to talk about joining a portal maybe together. And you can even talk to the two companies. They have representatives that will talk to you about how you can manage a portal for a group. That way, if the patient sees, let's say, you, Dr. Watto, and then comes to see another doctor, you can still see the data. It's not like specifically channeled just to you. It's to the practice. So I think it's actually wise to talk about this amongst your peers and to set it up as a group. We often try to avoid talking about brands. But there are two main products out there. It's probably useful to have to mention them. So Dexcom, and I'll just say I don't have an allegiance or any kind of relationship with either company. So just to say that for sure. But Dexcom is one of the main producers that has been out for quite a long time and updated their product. The most recent product's called the G7. And then the Abbott Freestyle is the other big system that's out there. They make the Libre system, and they have recently gone from the Libre 2 to the Libre 3 as their most updated version that has the transmitter and sensor in one and all of those features. I'll be honest, they're very comparable. They're becoming less different across time. The Dexcom system, the little sensor, is it popped on the arm. Same thing with the Libre. They're both rather popped on the arm with a little, it looks like a little pod that's handheld, and there's a firing button that it slaps it against the arm. It uses a small needle to insert the catheter. I'll be honest, I put these on 15 new patients a week. I mean, I have a startup clinic I'm doing now because of the use mm-hmm. picking up. And no one's ever said it's painful, ever. So it makes kind of a click sound. And then the needle is withdrawn out of this little auto device. And there's a catheter that's left inside that allows the glucose to be sensed by the small chemical reaction. The Dexcom can be worn for 10 days. Again, it's about the size of two stack quarters, and it's got a sticker underneath. You wear it through the shower. You can swim with it. No issues there. If you scrub over it, I guess it'll fall off. And then the Abbott Libre system can be worn for 14 days. So fairly similar.
Jeff, and with the sensor, you said that it doesn't hurt. Is it a sticker that they put on? They don't see any needle, right? Like you put it on and then you press a button and the needle puts the catheter in and then the needle retracts, but they're not going to see a needle, that kind of thing?
Totally. I'm trying to think of a common object that would look like this pod. You ever seen like a Keurig?
Yeah, like a K-cup.
It kind of looks like that. It's like a little pod and then you peel this aluminum, kind of like if you're pulling the aluminum off a K-cup, you basically mm-hmm. are peeling off and it exposes the internals of this mechanism. And then that is just held against the arm and the button on either of these fires it into the, I will say the Dexcom has a button and the Libre, you basically just push it against the skin and there's a little mechanism that when you press it against, it fires.
It fires, okay.
But yeah, they're actually, so the patients are taught to apply these themselves. If you're not great with the dexterity or kind of, they're usually put actually underneath the back of the arm. And when they're placed, the person, trying to think of how to describe how to hold the arm. If you were to flex your arm, like mm-hmm. like doing a...
Make a muscle, like a bicep, yeah.
Yeah, like you're flexing a bicep. You're kind of holding your arm up like that. And you do want to keep the arm kind of loose, but it's popped on the backside underneath the arm.
Yeah.
It's better to do it like this than try to turn the arm because it actually stretches the muscle a bit. And when you put it in, it can kink the catheter when you turn your arm over. So you want to have your arm kind of upright in this, like I'm flexing my bicep sort of position.
Yeah.
And then you pop it underneath the arm. That's the...
On the tricep.
Correct. Right on. Yep. Okay. And that's the best way to place it.
This episode is brought to you by Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. Gabby, a family medicine physician, and Irez, a computer engineer, came up with Freed, a solution that could help alleviate the daily burden of overworked clinicians everywhere. And for Irez, selfishly, it would mean that he could spend more time with Gabby, who is spending nights, weekends, and holidays updating medical documentation. Freed turns clinicians' daily workflow into accurate documentation instantly. There's no training time, no onboarding, and no extra mental burden. All of the magic happens in just a few clicks, so clinicians can spend less energy on charting and more time on doing what they do best. Today, more than 4,000 clinicians and their spouses have fallen in love with Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that does your medical documentation for you. Charting is critical and necessary, but it steals your focus away from your patients, eats away your time with your family, and keeps you up at night. The burden of always having another chart to complete drains every clinician. Freed is an AI scribe that makes charting go away. It does your SOAP notes for you. Freed listens, prepares your notes, and writes patient instructions. Charting is done before your patient walks out of the room. Freed learns your style over time, just like a human scribe, and it will never quit on you. Freed is loved by over 4,000 clinicians from every specialty. It is HIPAA compliant, takes only 30 seconds to learn, and costs only $99 per month. And you can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. And listeners of Curbsiders can use code CURB50 for $50 off their first month. So, Jeff, before I sign up for a patient portal, before I'm slapping things on the patient's biceps and having people make muscles, can you remind me who actually even qualifies for these in early 2024? I'm not sure we actually said that part out loud.
Yeah, no, that's great. And this is why we're getting together on this. And so back in around the April timeframe of 23, the Medicare and Medicaid updated the eligibility criteria to cover these devices. Prior, a person would have to be on what we call multiple daily injection regimen, meaning you had to be on multiple shots of fast-acting and some long-acting insulin in the day. So these are usually complex patients, many of them in a subspecialty office like myself. In April timeframe, they changed that to say that patients that are on even just one shot of insulin a day, so basal insulin, so if you're on just their glargine or any other basal they use, they are eligible to get insurance to cover this. And so most insurance provider system payers are falling in line with that because they usually follow along with Medicare, Medicaid. So I think an important reason why we're talking about this is that a lot of these tools were only in the subspecialty clinics. And I will say we've drastically picked up our use of them because it's easier to supply them and the insurance is just covering it. I think these are going to hit the primary care clinics a lot more because it's the types of patients aren't going to be those complex multiple injection users. You're going to have people that are on maybe just a basal insulin that will be acceptable to use it. And there's some other little criteria in there. So they have to be seen by the doctor 3 months after it's put on. And then they have to be evaluated by the prescribing provider every 6 months. The reason for that is they want the tool to be useful. And so they want the pattern of the sugar being evaluated and not just for the patient's own inspection. I do think it's valuable for the patient to look at the insights on their own, but the insurance criteria have that as an outlined step. And then they have like loose language in there, like the patient should be able to navigate and use a technology and understand the training. So, but yeah, I mean, a lot of our patients can use these now. I will say that there are studies that show it's not yet approved for coverage, but there are studies that show that people not even on any insulin that get on these devices, their A1C gets better on its own, just putting the device on. So you may think, well, how does that work? Like, what's the magic? And it's just that the patient's now seeing like, okay, well, I eat a bunch of pizza and my sugar goes, whoa, it really hits this peak. The sugars most people don't see are their postprandial numbers, the after the meal numbers. And when they can see these big bumps in sugar after eating something, a lot of people just automatically change their eating behaviors. And so, yeah, I mean, these are great devices. I really think the future state of diabetes is going to be finger sticks kind of go away. And part of that's the accuracy of these devices has gotten way better. I don't want to get into the statistics of what a mean absolute relative difference is, but the MARD is how they tell us how accurate these are. And they used to be not useful enough for the patient to treat based on the number. You could only look at a pattern and say, oh, I see a pattern. All of the modern devices are so accurate that the FDA has said patients can treat based on the number they see. It is accurate enough to say if I see a high or a low number, that's accurate and I respond to it. And unless I feel like it's off and need to do a finger stick to check it, you can just treat based on the number you see on the device.
Jeff, so what would I order for our patient, Mr. H here? Let's say he wants a CGM, he saw it advertised on TV. We think that would be a good idea because he's not really keen on sticking himself more than once a day. So what would an order look like? Like how long do they wear the sensor and what would we order?
Yeah, so the initial orders, depending on the healthcare system you work in, the first order, if they're going to get the reader I mentioned, so like let's say he won't use the smartphone, those often have to be purchased through a prosthetics department or through like a discussion with the prosthetics workflow.
Like a DME company?
Yeah, like a DME. Yeah, exactly. And so those come from there. The sensors, though, come from pharmacy. And they can get them from whatever pharmacy they get their medications from. And so you basically would prescribe either the Dexcom, which is going to be three sensors, covers them for a month. Usually these are done for a month. I guess you could do up to 3 months. I usually have not done it that way. And I think maybe I could get to doing that. Part of that is there are some supply issues because these are getting used up so quickly. Mm-hmm. I do think the pharmacy is a little bit nervous about handing out a big amount of these and then having them kind of get lost or think something. They have been in the past fairly expensive. They're actually getting a little bit more affordable to where if you wanted one without insurance, you might even be able to just buy them. I mean, if they're not exorbitant.
And some people might just want to do it for a month just to see what's what, right? And you just buy three. So each sensor is 10 days.
Yeah, so for the Dexcom. And then to go to talk about the Abbott Freestyle system, the Libre system, those last for 14 days. So you need to write for two sensors for the month. And again, if they're not needing a reader, they basically download the app for either Dexcom or the Libre, whichever system they're getting. The Dexcom has two apps they need to get. They're getting the newest sensor. It's going to be the G7 app. It's on the Google Play Store and on the Apple Store. And they need to download their patient portal called the Clarity. So they need to have, that's the cloud basically. And they run both apps on their smartphone. For the Libre system, all they have to do is download the Libre and the app. It's called Freestyle Libre 3. And they go to the Play Store or the app, Apple Store, and they download it, install it. And it walks the patient through. It actually has pictures of how to put the sensor on, how to pair it. They have to allow the Bluetooth connection. It's actually pretty self-explanatory. I will say one of the things I'm learning, and this is not meant to be ageist at all, but a lot of people of every age struggle with like remembering a password that they make for an account. And so this can be actually a little bit of a challenge for people that aren't, you know, using their cell phone a lot and making accounts and just some of the routine stuff that you do when you set up an app. Mm-hmm. A lot of individuals, they really want these. They get family members involved if they're not good with their device. So anyhow, that's how they set it up.
Okay. So the 1 meter is the Dexcom has three sensors per month, 10 days each. Freestyle has two sensors per month, about 14 days each.
Yep. That's it.
And let's say Mr. H gets his new continuous glucose monitor. He's wearing it now. He's using his smartphone and he comes back to see us. Like what are we going to be looking at? Let's say we don't yet have our practice hasn't set up a portal for providers yet. So what would be the best way to look at his data at that visit?
Yeah, so like you'd mentioned, the portals are a useful tool, partly because you can get the data and then you can copy paste it into your note, which is nice. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have the portal set up, you can still do okay. The patient can pull up their smartphone and you can literally just, you know, if they're okay handing their phone to you, once you pull up the app, you can just scroll through and look at the graphics of the glucose. There are daily trends. There's a lot of different things that the apps, they're frequently updating, but they try to show insights. One of the pieces of data that's probably the most important is something that's called time in range, or TIR. And you'll see with the American Diabetes Association, they've put out the A1C target, which I think most providers are very familiar with. And the time and range target to try to achieve for most people would be to get the goal glucose, so between 100, so a lot of them actually listed as 70, but so between 70 to 180 is considered time and range. Mm-hmm. And you want to have them in that range at least 70% of the time. Mm-hmm. So a good way to remember that, so we all have remembered A1C of 7, you know, get less than 7. Older, sicker patients, between 7 and 8 is a target. But you can remember time in range 70%, and you want to get in range more than 70% of the time. It will also, each CGM will list out to you right on the front page, and it'll be on his smartphone. It'll give you the amount of time that he's low and very low. And you certainly just want to minimize those. I mean, less than 3% in the low would be great. In the very low, it should be 0 if you can. Those are dangerous. And then it'll tell you the amount of time hyperglycemic. And obviously, if time in range is going to be more than 70%, the hyper and very hyperglycemia, you'd want to have just less than 30%, of course. And so you can just quickly inspect the statistics. It's pretty easy. And then you'll look at the daily graphs. And this is where it gets to be difficult if the patient has not been doing a little journaling. You know, you can try to have them go through and say, okay, even if they haven't been, you can say, you know, walk me through a usual day. You'll often see some bumps maybe around breakfast or lunch or dinner. You might see the graphic, you know, drop out overnight. And those all will give us insights we'll talk about in our pattern management on our talk here. But you can still use that information and say, what do you think you're usually doing? And then try to pin down what the medications and activities are doing to their sugar. It's ideal to have a little bit of some journaling of, well, here's what I've been eating. Here's my exercise time. I remember being low at this time and I was, you know, like cutting the lawn a long time or whatever it was. I want to say something else just quickly too. Time and range is very important, more so than an A1C. It responds more quickly to our medical interventions, any changes we do for the patient. We know an A1C, it's a 3-month capture. Time and range is your glucose now, and in particular for the last testing period. So if it's a Dexcom, it's the last 10-day sensor or the last 14 days on the Libre. I will say the other thing about CGMs is they reflect glucose variability, whereas an A1C doesn't. So I could have a glucose that is like 126 all day and all night. It's the only time in medicine we like a flat line. it is a graphic of my glucose across the day. But if I was 126 across the day, my A1C would be a 6. Or I could be like 60s and like 250s, like back and forth, back and forth, and I could still look like an A1C of 6. And so A1C doesn't reflect glycemic variability, and a lot of times the finger sticks people do aren't enough to show that either. And then the last thing I'll say is that the CGMs are not affected by physiologic or pathologic factors that will affect the A1C. So we talked about this a lot before, but just briefly, you know, if I have a iron deficiency anemia and my red cells are circulating longer, they will build up sugar and falsely elevate the A1C. None of that stuff affects a CGM. And so there's none of those factors. Now, I will say there are some factors that can affect the sensor readings, and those are explicitly updated by the sensor. So high-dose vitamin C is one thing that can affect the sensor. There's a variety of things that they continually list for these sensors as they improve the sensors that can interfere with readings. But yeah, those are key items about it.
And Jeff, as I'm being attacked by my cat here for the people who are just listening. So it's nice to have these trends. I'm sure these graphs are extraordinarily helpful. But if someone is, say, in the very low, do these things have the capacity to like alarm in real time? Same thing for, I guess, very significant hyperglycemia.
Yeah,
do you get notifications for that kind of thing?
You've picked up on probably one of the most key features of these that is helpful for patients. So yeah, when they're, you can adjust the alarms too. So ideally, if they're using a smartphone or even with the reader, they'll have an alarm. And the you can set it for whatever sugar you want. So if your individual tends to get in trouble kind of fast, you could set the low alarm at like 90. You don't have to wait till they get to 70. So you can adjust that. And the alarm can make their smartphone buzz. It can have their alert go to a family member. So you can have lots of safety kind of built in. I will say one of the things I've noticed is that for my people, I'm trying to help their sugars when they're kind of getting high sugar a lot and they're getting their alarm going off a lot. It's defaults at 250, which a lot of our patients are struggling above that until we are helping them get down. But they kind of are like, oh, this thing's alarming all the time. I'm just going to turn it off or put it in the other room. And I don't know why I made an older person kind of voicing there. I'm sorry if I'm not trying to be ageist.
But that's what I sound
really,
like.
It really brought me there. I felt like I was in the room with the patient.
It's kind of just like it's a grumpy voice, but it's like, you know, get this thing out of here. Well, if they just, you know, get rid of it, you know, that's not helpful. So if they're struggling with, I'll just tell them temporarily, let's get that high number. And you can also reset that to a higher number. But yeah, you keyed into one of the key features is that when you're doing finger sticks, you're only poking your finger when you think that you should be or if I'm feeling kind of sick, whereas this is constantly checking the sugar. One last thing I should say, though, also, is that the continuous glucose monitor, it's not testing blood sugar. It's actually testing interstitial fluid. And that is in an equilibrium with our blood sugar, but it's about 15 minutes delayed from what the blood sugar is. So let's say my blood sugar is like screaming down. I took a bunch of insulin, I haven't eaten enough, and my sugar is like screaming down. By the time the CGM, which is again 15 minutes delayed, is showing some alert signs, my blood sugar actually might be much lower already and in a hypoglycemia causing some health problems. So that's one of the reasons why for people that struggle with that, I will try to get their low alert to set to a higher point so we can catch it before we get way down into the lower numbers. They are constantly improving these CGMs, so that period of time of delay is getting shorter and shorter. But it's usually listed or somewhere between 10 to 15 minutes delayed.
So the delay is not a big deal if your sugar, like you said, is like the ideal, right, where it's just kind of staying similar because it'll be the same 15 minutes from now as it is now. But if it's screaming up or screaming down, then you're going to be, you know, behind what's actually happening.
Yeah, and that's one of the key pieces of teaching that patients get. One other brief piece of teaching is that, you know, you might think, why is having more data harmful to a person? Like, why would that ever be bad? So if a person has fast-acting insulin, a lot of our patients, they really want to have better blood sugar. When you think about what you're doing with a finger stick, you're usually testing before your meals. And usually if I'm testing, like, let's say, for example, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, it's kind of naturally spaced like 4 to 6 hours apart. Fast-acting insulin, like aspart or any of the other fast-actings, you know, its duration of action is 4 hours. You know, so its onset's 15 minutes, its peak is an hour, and it's off in 4 hours. So between my meals and my testings, I'm going to be okay not stacking the insulin. An issue with the CGMs that I've noticed, and part of the teaching for patients, is if I am checking my sugar all the time, I'll have patients that, like, say, eat their breakfast, they take their fast acting, and then like an hour or two later, they're like, oh, dang, my sugar's like 250, 300. Well, I'll just take some more insulin. I got to get this thing fixed. And they'll take a dose. And then an hour later, they'll look, ah, it's still kind of high. I'll take a dose. Well, their breakfast dose hasn't had its fullness of time to work. And so they're stacking insulin doses because they're doing their insulin before that full 4 hours is done. That is one of my concerns with these devices. And patients, that's a safety feature. People have to be told, you know, follow the regimen, show us the patterns, you know, don't start taking any extra insulin yet. Okay. So that's a big one to bring out.
All right. Well, let's start getting into some patterns, Paul. So, Paul, do you want to read the first pattern here? You can read the case and we'll talk about
it. Sure. So we'll talk about Mr. H again. So we'll say his CGM shows his glucose is above 180 to 200 milligrams per deciliter after lunch and bedtime. So his blood sugar will actually dip to 65 milligrams per deciliter overnight. And in the morning, he's got these kind of nice fasting blood sugars of 100 to 130 milligrams per deciliter. So we've uncovered he's having some nocturnal hypoglycemia. How do we troubleshoot this? And what kind of adjustments can we make?
Well, first, just to say, it's amazing that the CGM picked up on it. So normally, you know, you're not finger sticking in the middle of the night unless you're actually woken by the low. Lows usually do wake people. You know, you've got a few mechanisms that a healthy person. So number one, the beta cells stop making insulin. Number two, glucagon's released by the alpha cells cause liver to release its glycogen storage. Then you get into three and four, which is growth hormone and cortisol release. Those are some stress hormone responses, and the person usually will wake from those. Cortisol wakes us. It's the hormone that wakes us in the morning, and it raises sugar. And the fifth response of hypoglycemia is the fight or flight hormones from the adrenals. So your epinephrine, norepinephrine, which causes your shakiness and your kind of high alert state. Those usually will wake the patient and those people might finger stick. But we caught this pattern now with the CGM. And so I'm curious to know what he's been doing. Some people, they're not responding at all. And those counter-regulatory hormone systems are just bringing the sugar up on its own. I interestingly had a patient ask me in clinic recently, they said, is that okay if I'm not like staying low, if I just let my body fix it? It is not. All of those hormones are damaging. I was like, please don't do that. That's, I mean, not only will you feel terrible, hypoglycemia is a very, it feels terrible, but it's damaging and it's dangerous. It's a stress test on the heart. And it, over time, recurrent hypoglycemia can cause brain damage and dementia risk. So anyhow, the rule of 15 is a person's instructed to eat 15 grams of carb, which is usually 4 glucose tablets or 4 ounces of juice or regular soda. And then you wait 15 minutes and test. And so you can follow your CGM. You know, you can have them take their sugar treatment and follow the CGM. I'm just curious to know what this guy has been doing. Has he been riding it through the night or had no idea? And then it's just brought up in the morning? Or has he been eating stuff in the middle of the night because he's low? And so that I do want to address, how he's doing it, do good hypoglycemia teaching with him. And then you want to reduce his basal insulin. So we had mentioned he's on metformin and he's on basal. some individuals, like he's got CKD3, I would wonder, is his kidney disease kind of progressing and therefore the basal insulin's hanging around longer and causing him to get low in the middle of the night? So you want to reduce his basal insulin. And that's going to be step one. You know, what's fascinating is sometimes when you do that, you lower his insulin, and you're like, this guy's A1C is 8.6. You're telling me to reduce his insulin? Are you nuts? What kind of doctor are you? It's fascinating. Sometimes you'll see their A1C go down and you're like, how is that possible? Well, if he's low every night and he's eating a ton of sugar to bring it up, that's going to be blasting his sugar up. Or just all the counter-regulatory hormones I mentioned, they actually, for about 24 hours, create a physiologic situation of insulin-less responsiveness, so insensitivity. So for an entire day after the low event, his body does a less good job responding to insulin, which can be raising his sugar too. So just by lowering the basal, preventing the nocturnal hypoglycemia, you're going to lower this guy's A1C. So this is, I'm glad that you made this the first case. This is a common concern. Hypoglycemia has been a priority for all of the guideline organizations, and we want to not overtreat him. Now, later on, if he has highs in the day, that would indicate we should add some other medications. And we'd probably be considering, if it's postprandial highs, a GLP-1, an SGLT2 inhibitor, or prandial dose insulin would be our usual option.
Our episode today is sponsored by Panacea Financial, a nationwide digital bank built for doctors by doctors. Did you know, according to new research, that 19% of residents and fellows work over 80 hours per week? Or that 36% of residents and fellows take on additional work outside of their training programs? Did you know that 54% of residents and fellows rate their financial stress at an 8 or higher out of 10? We all know that residents and fellows are an essential part of the U.S. healthcare system, and they endure rigorous training, long hours, and financial strain during this time. Panacea Financial has just released their 2024 Residents and Fellows Survey Report, sharing findings from the experiences of over 600 current U.S. residents and fellows. In this report, find an in-depth look at the successes, challenges, and stressors that this group faces and where change is most needed. Download the full report for free at panaceafinancial.com/report. Panacea Financial is a division of Primis, member FDIC. I love that. The number of patients that I've had that will endorse having just the worst possible food imaginable on their bedside stand for when they become hypoglycemic overnight and then sort of counterbalance it by eating like half a sleeve of Oreos. Like I can't fault them, but also
it's when you're low, you're just going nuts. It's hard to just eat a little bit. Yeah.
And Paul, I had no idea that the insulin resistance for 24 hours, that is probably protective because your body's like, oh, I almost died. I don't want insulin to be able to do its job as well because that could kill me. So that seems like it's good that that's built in, but you know, if you're trying to control diabetes, that works against you.
And that's why priority one in the pattern recognition for CGM patterns is to, number one, address lows and make modifications to the regimen to reduce the lows before we even start trying to do other things. And it's just so surprised. So many times I've seen people's A1Cs get better by reducing regimens, and it's just safer too.
Okay. All right, Paul, we have another case for Jeff.
You bet your sweet bippy. Watto. So we have Mr. H. I think it's going to be Mr. H. No, it's not Mr. H all day long. But Mr. H joins the gym. Good for him. Starts Orange Theory. Shout out Uncle Bob. He's doing workouts every afternoon around 3 p.m. He had to stop several recent workouts because he's having some nausea and some dizziness. He has not checked his blood sugar during these episodes. So we now have the CGM, so we could possibly do some detective work. But if we didn't, sir, what would you think would be happening and what we can do to make some adjustments here?
Yeah, so I'm glad that we're staying in the hypoglycemia kind of thinking pathway. And so it seems like we've primed this up for us to know what's happening. Like I mentioned, one of the hardest things is just seeing patterns of sugar and not knowing what were the events. And so this is where, if he had been doing some journaling to say, here, I'm doing Orange Theory at this time, and then his CGM is showing these dips down after the exercise. What's interesting is that for people, intense physical exercise, it can actually, for the first 30 minutes, raise blood sugar. And then after you go for longer than an hour of exercise, the blood sugar will tend to go down and become hypoglycemic. And for up to 5 hours after exercise, you are more insulin responsive. So your insulin sensitivity improves. And you can have hypoglycemia for up to 5 hours, very related to the exercise. And so I think you've given a good stem here to say he's probably the workout. He's got the symptoms, but we didn't have the data. He's on the CGM. And so what can we do? And so for this gentleman, again, we might choose, it's the same gentleman with the glargine and the metformin. We might decide to reduce some of his basal insulin. Maybe now he's actually in a better health pattern and he doesn't need as much of that. And because of this exercise, and so you just need to, again, back off his regimen and then use the CGM to detect areas to improve. But that's how I'd start with him.
Yeah. Do you ever have patients take a snack before exercise? Is that something that sometimes people have to do?
Yeah, it's more so type 1s, but type 2s as well. I mean, anyone on insulin at mealtimes are more of the risk to have the lows like this. If they are getting lows after exercise, the best snack, and again, your food preference will dictate, but there's been papers on having a person take a half banana and add some peanut butter to it. Now, if you don't like peanut butter and bananas, then I can't, there's other things
then
you can try.
You're a freak, but okay.
Yeah. Kids like it. So, I mean, it's like kids eat nothing and they'll eat this. So, like, it must be good. The rationale is that there's a complex carb that's going to break down slow, and you have some protein and fat. So you have a mixture of foods. You don't want to like drink Gatorade. You don't want to, you know, just taking sugar itself, it actually does poorly because you just get a big spike up. You can just crash afterwards. So it's just not that helpful. So it's usually going to be something that's like, maybe there's a lot of different protein bars out there. They usually have a mixture of protein, fats, and sugars. Those might be actually okay. Like a little protein bar could be good. A lot of them have a lot of junk in it.
Burgundy milk approach.
Oh, I'm sorry, what's that?
I said the Ron Burgundy milk approach might be worthwhile here. Then you get your protein, you got some sugars in there.
Yeah, maybe, but I won't endorse that. But yeah, there's I think that's actually a good strategy, Matt, is to have a little snack that you don't necessarily treat with more insulin on, and that can carry them over versus just trying to have them drop some insulin somewhere, reduce some of their dose. But a lot of people may not know, oh, I'm exactly going to exercise at this time. They've already got the insulin on board.
Right.
So what do? You take a snack.
Okay. And before we leave hypoglycemia land, if someone was on a sulfonylurea and maybe not insulin, but they're still, I've still had some patients not on insulin having that nocturnal hypoglycemia. Like if they're on the twice a day sulfonylurea, do you knock out the evening dose or how do you troubleshoot that?
Yeah, sulfonylureas can be tricky because, you know, they're supposed to be taken with food because they do have that immediate insulin release of the beta cells that's what they're doing. Some of them can cause a lingering effect on the beta cell. It basically poisons the little potassium channel that allows the beta cell to glucose detect. So instead of having the beta cell say, I wonder what the sugar is. Okay, it's about here. I should make more insulin. It just says, blast out insulin. And some people, there's a prolonged effect of those drugs, usually in renal failure patients and in the elderly. So yeah, I would try to get away from that drug for a patient having that issue, or maybe, like you say, drop the evening dose. Mm-hmm. If you can, I mean, sulfonylureas cause weight gain. They don't have added organ benefit outside of the sugar lowering. So we all know that probably the only reason we use that nowadays is because a person doesn't have good insurance to cover the better products. So,
I find it's pretty tough on Medicare. Like Medicare, the newer agents are really tough for a lot of patients on Medicare to get. I guess because of the donut hole, the copays tend to be really high.
Yeah. And we could talk all day about the medication costs, but
All right. Thank you. So we'll go on to another, Paul. I think we have another case here for Jeff.
Sure enough, we got Ms. J. She's a 42-year-old female. She weighs 90 kilograms. She has obesity, hypertension, dyslipidemia, metabolic-associated steatotic liver disease, and type 2 diabetes. She takes metformin XR 2,000 milligrams daily and degludec 25 units every morning. Her bedtime glucose is anywhere between 180 to 250 milligrams per deciliter, and her fasting glucoses are 80 to 130 milligrams per deciliter. She does not check after meals, and her last A1C is 9%. So we have this patient who's got pretty good fasting blood glucoses, but nighttime sugars are up. So how do we troubleshoot this, and what kind of things can we go after here?
So a couple of things. You know, she's 42. Maybe on the young side, average age of type 2 diabetes is 49. So I might kind of investigate, you know, some type 1 antibodies. It nothing in the stem overtly says, but I'm just going to mention that. I like how you updated the non-alcoholic fatty liver to the metabolic associated. They keep changing that terminology, but I'll try to keep up. But you did good with that. So, okay, let's try to get on track here with, you know, she has what looks like a glucose pattern where she's doing fine fasting. And this is actually frequently the case for patients because I think we're most comfortable with and start with medications like basal insulin, and she's on the metformin. And those are mostly going to affect fasting sugars. Metformin works by decreasing the hepatic output of sugar. So that's mostly fasting effect. Dr. DeFranzo, who's one of the bigwigs in diabetes, he does not think that metformin is an insulin sensitizer, although we've all learned that in med school, and he has a lot of talks on this. And then degludec, of course, is a basal, and both of those are directed at the fasting, which look good. But this person's A1C is elevated above target. You know, 9 would be certainly above anywhere she should get at her age. And then her bedtime glucose is a clue that she's building sugar across the day, which is because she's eating in the day. And so the CGM can help because it can show you which meals are mostly problematic and the patterns of high. And again, you could choose to start a number of agents, like we'd mentioned, SGLT2, GLP-1, even DPP-4 inhibitor maybe. Probably not going to get the A1C down enough with that one. Or potentially prandial insulin to attack. And usually I would start with the biggest meal. So it'd be nice with the CGM to say, oh, okay, well, your sugar is like the highest after breakfast. Sometimes that's the case. We are the most insulin resistant after breakfast due to cortisol waking us in the morning. And then breakfast foods tend to be carbohydrate heavy. You know, cereals and pancakes and things tend to hurt people's sugars a lot more. Now, it could be that dinner, the biggest meal. And so, again, a little bit of a log from her, a CGM could help us a lot. And I think she's having some postprandial hyperglycemia. And like I'd mentioned, there's a lot of ways you can approach that.
And Jeff, I just wanted to mention, because you mentioned the daily readings on the CGM, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it gives you like a graph, right, where the y-axis is blood glucose and the x-axis is the time of day, right? And then it'll show you like a whole week or a whole 10 days, and it'll kind of give you a range like, okay, at breakfast, they tend to be in this range, and it shows you if they have times that are really high or really low throughout all those. So you kind of get this sort of like, it's almost like a wave across the page, right?
Yeah.
So this is what we'd be looking at if she had a CGM.
Yeah, it'll show you all of these will have, they'll show you a stacked overlay, which will show you the overall pattern. So you can say, oh, it looks like you're high like every morning. And then you can actually go down and look at the daily pattern for the last in the testing period. So you can see, like, let's say their weekend is they're much higher because they're doing other weekend activities that they don't do in the week. So you can kind of break it down by the day for the person.
Okay.
And it's really interesting. There's some studies showing that people like not on any, although this is not currently where the approvals from insurance pay for these devices, but not on any insulins, their A1Cs get better just because without doing anything special, just giving it to the patient, because a person is looking and saying, oh, I eat that and my sugar goes up like that, and they're seeing it real time and the graphic, they tend to make some different food choices. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's helpful for that.
And then one other follow-up question. You mentioned, so thinking about postprandial hyperglycemia, I always try not to start a prandial insulin for my patients with type 2. So you mentioned GLP-1s, SGLT2s, and maybe DPP-4s probably have a less of an insulin-lowering effect. Would you say the GLP-1s have the most effect and then the SGLT2s, then the DPP-4s if you're kind of looking to control postprandial hyperglycemia?
Yeah, I think that's correct. The GLP-1s and particularly some of the newer products coming out that have the additional receptor functions, the GIP.
Like the GIP.
And
GLP-1/GLP-1.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So tirzepatide and then semaglutide and dulaglutide. There are several of the GLP-1s that are very good. And yeah, they do a great job with decreasing appetite. They have mechanisms that are central to nervous system and brain responsiveness to nutrition to decrease food-seeking behaviors, in addition to lowering liver sugar output and decreasing the speed at which foods process in the GI tract, which is where most of the side effects come from because you're getting some GI slowing. The SGLT2 inhibitor, it just lowers the renal threshold to reclaim glucose. So if you have a big spike after a meal, the kidneys will have a easier time offloading the sugar through the urinary system. But it does seem to have less impact on postprandial glucose. But to be honest, if you can get them on both products, and it's hard sometimes with insurance, it could help a lot. And both have a weight losing and all of the added cardiovascular renal benefits that we know for both of those products.
Okay. All right. So we can definitely help Miss J with her postprandial hyperglycemia with that. All right, Paul. Let's go to the next iteration.
All right. Still Ms. J. She's still on metformin, still on degludec 25 units every morning. But in this scenario, her bedtime glucose is less than 180 to 200 milligrams per deciliter. Fasting glucose is imperfect at 150 to 200 milligrams per deciliter. And her last A1C is 9%. So what does this pattern suggest to you, Jeff? And what kind of things can we do to tweak it?
Yeah, so I'll just say degludec may not be a basal that people are as familiar with. It is a basal that has been designed to try to have a longer half-life and duration of action, and so that it has the time can be moved around and potentially has less peak effect, particularly when heavy doses are used. It's mostly used for people that have type 1, not so much, but you can use it for anybody. Maybe one people aren't as familiar with. But, you know, you're mentioning that her bedtime glucose is actually doing really well and that her fasting sugar is looking a little bit higher. And so this is an individual that might actually need some more basal insulin, because it seems like between the time of her bedtime and when she's waking up, we're seeing the numbers kind of rising. And so this individual, you know, if she's, we didn't mention her metformin dose, but we could have her go up on the metformin. You know, the max is 1,000 twice a day, so 2,000 total. Or if you're using metformin extended release, they can technically take all of the 2,000 at one time. Some people, they get GI upset from that, but that's technically permissible to do. Or we could dial up on her basal insulin, her degludec. It's interesting, although, you know, the GLP-1 SGLT2 are mostly directed against a lot of their action is at the postprandial time. Introducing either of those agents potentially can help this individual as well. So those wouldn't be, you know, out of the routine to consider for the patient. I think we have to try to figure out, is she snacking at nighttime, or is this just a rise that's occurring overnight because her basal medications aren't strong enough? But yeah, she's on the two right products that probably just need to be brought up potentially.
Jeff, you gave us a bunch of options there. And, I know your mentor, one of your mentors in diabetes always says that what he liked about doing diabetes care was that there's always more than one right answer, or usually more than one right answer.
Yeah, and that can frustrate people that are trying to practice diabetes care, because in medicine, you know, we can feel a little bit, we want to seek the best thing for our patient, of course. And when it seems like there's just so many potential options, we maybe scare ourselves out of being involved because we're worried we're making the wrong decision. I will honestly say that, you know, there are just so many right ways you can go. It's what the patient also is willing to do. Sometimes very complex regimens are difficult. Their work life and home life, their finances dictate a lot. And so whenever I see a case brought to me as a subspecialist, you know, whatever things had come about for a person to be on what they were on were just what it had to be. There's just so many factors to just talk about that are involved in the decision-making, but you're exactly right. And that's why we look for curbsides or for a subspecialty consult so that you can get them to the next step if it's not working out.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask for the metformin XR, the extended release one, if I prescribe two 750 milligram tabs, or I believe that's the highest, the biggest strength, rather than prescribing four 500 milligram tabs, do you think there's a big difference between like a 1500 milligram total daily dose and a 2000 milligram total daily dose?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't think there's much difference between them. Technically, guidelines say to try to get people to the maximal tolerated dose, but just clinically, I don't think there would be a big difference.
Yeah.
And you're right. We want to hone in on what's more doable. Sometimes taking more pills, it's really interesting. We talk about diabetes distress. You know, diabetes is a lot of work. It's intrusive to your food. And just, I think it's on people's minds a lot lately. There's all of these, you know, magic cures for body weight now. And the medications aren't that, actually. They're very helpful, much more than had been in the past, but we put a lot on people. And I think I'm going to make a broad statement, but I just feel like people are very stressed nowadays. And diabetes is just seems like just another thing that's constantly intrusive to your day and always thinking about it. And so, yeah, I think simplifying is good.
I don't know, Paul, do any of your patients like taking like 4 horse pills every day?
No one's clamoring for more gigantic pills in their day.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we'll throw a little potassium supplement in there too. Just can't get enough.
Paul, I think we have one more scenario here.
Sure. We've got Mr. V is a 71-year-old male with type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity, CKD 3B with an albumin creatinine ratio of 60. He weighs 110 kilograms and takes Glipizide XL 10 milligrams daily, Detemir 10 units twice daily. He cannot tolerate metformin. His blood sugars are in the 200s to 300s basically all the time whenever he happens to check. He brings in a log of 2 weeks of finger sticks that show both pre- and postprandial hyperglycemia, I should say. So where do you start with this patient, Jeff?
So a lot of times when my residents or students or fellows are presenting to me, you know, they'll come with this graphic and the sugars are all really high and the students trainees very distressed and like, oh, it's just high everywhere. And I'm like, oh, this is a great pattern. we need to add medicine or have them take the medicine that they're on. But when it's like a mixture of lows and highs, those are very challenging because it's like, okay, what lows are prompting highs? And then it's like, but the high all the time, fasting and postprandial hyperglycemia is what this person's having. That's very doable. You included in the script, and maybe I should have told you ahead of time, but this will be a good teaching point, that they're on Detemir 10 units twice a day. Well, Detemir is actually going off the market. The company that manufactures that is no longer going to produce it. So that'll be an easy change we have to make. We got to get them off that.
Because good riddance.
I think good riddance, Paul. I think this month or next month's going to be the last that you can actually technically even get it. So, I mean, we'll probably put them on once a day basal insulin, so that'll make life easier than being on a twice a day. You often don't need to do twice a day. Sometimes when you get really high doses of basal, like above 80 units of glargine, which is technically as high as you can twist the pen up to, we try to split it twice a day, but often you don't have to do that. So let's get back in on the case here. He's not tolerating metformin. He's on the Glipizide XL, which as a older person with CKD, not my favorite choice. And he's got sugars that are 200 and 300s all the time, high in the morning, fasting, and after meals. You might want to see, like, a couple of things I'm going to look for with the CGM. So if he's going to bed with a sugar of, like, let's say 250, and he's waking up in the morning with a sugar of, like, 170, 180, well, even though he's technically hyperglycemic in the morning and like postprandial in the evening, you have to really recognize that that sugar is taking, like when he's asleep and fasting, that sugar is taking a pretty big fall, quite a bit over that nighttime period. So you could imagine instead of going to bed at 250 and waking up at like 180, if I have him go to bed more at like 180, he's going to be waking up with sugars that are getting close to hypoglycemia. So you really have, that's one area I focus on in these patients, is I look at that bedtime to morning time drop and make sure I don't over basal the patient. Mm-hmm. So we do want to start him on some basal insulin, depending on how his fasting sugar looks and on that nighttime drop. That's the first thing to assess, is the basal needs. Backing up, we assess for hypoglycemia first, which in this stem he's not having. But the first thing you address is basal needs. Then you address prandial needs. And so if he's still having highs with pretty high-dosed glipizide and he's taking it once a day, I wouldn't really be excited to fill that out for all of his meals. And it doesn't seem like he does great on that product overall. If you could, if he had insurance coverage, again, this is a guy with CKD. I would love to have him on SGLT2 inhibitor, and then maybe GLP-1 as well after that. And so try to treat his comorbidities with the products, and then improve his prandial glucose as well. Now, if that approach doesn't yet yield sugars that are great for the prandial time, meaning mealtime, then you should then look to do some mealtime insulin. I often wait till after we've tried the other products if they're available, partly because mealtime insulin doesn't have the added organ benefit and will usually come with weight gain across time. And it has more risk, certainly risk of hypoglycemia when they're overtreating. It's just technically challenging. I also want to just say, though, that mealtime insulin or fast-acting insulin is not a bad guy. And I feel like we often, for these types of patients that are just high all the time, we wait too long to get them on some insulin. It's not the worst thing. Sometimes it's instead of adding a whole bunch of medicines, you add one new intervention, which is mealtime insulin. You slowly bring the doses up. And let's say, you know, that you get them controlled and they're doing better and feeling better. You can either leave that running, or you might introduce at that point, like a GLP-1 SGLT2 inhibitor, and just back off on the mealtime insulin. So there's no right or wrong way. Either fix the basal, add on the SGLT2 GLP-1, and then go for the mealtime insulin, or add on the basal and add on the mealtime insulin, and then you can seek the other products when you get your prior authorizations through, which take forever, and the finances, and all of that stuff. So I know that I gave you kind of two styles to go, but I think both patterns work. Now, let's say he has very poor finances. You know, you could have him get the glipizide with more of his meals in the day. You have to have him be watchful for hypoglycemia. He does have to eat with that product. And then you could change that Detemir to the once-a-day basal. So there's a range of options you can choose. But the CGM will help you, because when you make all these little changes, you keep him on that CGM, and then he can come back and you can look at the pattern and you can tweak it even better. And he can be really on the lookout for hypoglycemia with that. So,
and Jeff, I want to make sure I'm understanding this conceptually, because I've seen the sulfonylurea basal insulin combination before. And I was like, that just doesn't make sense to me, because I always think of sulfonylureas as a Hail Mary pass to keep people off of insulin. But it sounds like this is serving the duty of your prandial insulin, and you're trying to avoid it. Am I understanding that correctly, at least in some cases?
I'm 100% with you. I think it's a stopgap while we're trying to educate up the patient or get them into a resource area, like if they need some specialty consult or diabetes education. It's a bit of a stopgap to try to help them get beta cell insulin release. I agree. I'm not a big fan of basal insulin plus the sulfonylurea. I think truly if they need sulfonylurea, probably some dosed insulin is going to be very reasonable. But I think it's used a lot as a stopgap while we're waiting to get them to that resource. I think a lot of primary care clinics are maybe not yet set up to have prandial insulin used, but I don't want to take that away from anybody. I mean, I think with CGMs, all of these tools are going to become a lot easier to manage in a lot of settings. The big hurdles are going to be getting it new into your workflows. I think it can be a time saver over time once a provider and practice get used to it, because you can basically get their data off the cloud. You can copy and paste it into your note instead of like laboriously going through their bloody finger stick chart and trying to figure out, make sense of things. But anything new is going to be a challenge to get to be efficient and to be, you know, someone's, we call it the FFT, the freaking first time. The first time you do anything, it's just very frustrating. And it, I think once providers use these tools and get them in their workflows, I feel like they're going to never want to go back just because the finger stick thing, it just doesn't get you the data you need to help people.
Yeah. Well, we've gone over a lot of really helpful stuff. I mean, I feel like now I know how to order and how much to order, what like the sensors, and also just going over these common scenarios that I'm sure people in the audience are seeing every day. And then just because we briefly mentioned it this time and you mentioned it last time as well, I really like the idea of like everyone that starts prandial insulin doesn't have to start 3 times a day prandial insulin. Like, you know, you mentioned you could start it with just your largest meal of the day. And I have a fair amount of patients that only eat one like true meal. Like a lot of them are just sort of like some small snacks throughout the day. So I do like that option. And that's still only 2, if they're on a basal and with their largest meal, it's still only 2 injections a day. So it's a good option to think about.
Yeah. I think, like you mentioned, you really want to seek the patient. You want to see what are they willing to do? What is their support set up like at home for themselves, their nutrition, their finances, you know, what are they capable to keep up with? And we make changes to try to help them get to their goals. Yeah.
Paul, any final comments before we go to take home points?
In this last case in particular, you know, we've talked in our hypertension episodes about this sort of pseudo-resistant hypertension, which is just patients maybe burdened by the medications they take. And I feel like this is a chance for Mr. V here to actually make sure that he's actually taking his insulin. Like usually I think you see that in the the patients where you keep cranking up the dose and just nothing happens. But, and he's in our theoretically on a fairly low dose, but I think it's also a nice chance to kind of go back and just check adherence for these patients who just don't seem to budge no matter what you kind of throw at them. And just make sure there's no barriers to cost or administration or storage, which can be the case in a lot of folks that are maybe a little bit embarrassed to talk about it.
You know, Matt, when you asked Paul for his like wrap up summary, my computer, it just totally glitched out. So I think that's just a sign that I don't know that Paul needs to stay. I got, again, I'm putting my application out there. I'm telling you, my computer, it knew something. You just wanted to block my application's out.
I feel like you're expecting a fight, Jeff. I will hand the crown to you. It is.
Well, we're going to go toe-to-toe at some point on one of these. We'll get together at one of these national
meetings. I don't want to.
Paul, I feel like Jeff wants a fight, and Paul's like, nah, I'm just, all the fight's out of me. I'm just,
I was broken years ago. I'll just passive resist my way through it.
No, but I was hearing the last bit of your summary statement, and I guess I didn't catch it.
It was
all
brilliant. Don't even worry about
it.
I'm
sure it was amazing.
It was. So, Jeff, this has been a lot of fun, as always, and we'll definitely have to have you back, as we do every year in the future. But what are some take-home points that you'd really like the listeners to remember from this one?
Yeah, a couple of things. So continuous glucose monitors, because of Medicare and Medicaid updates to the eligibility, are going to become much more widely available. If you have a patient who's on basal insulin only, they can access this device with insurance coverage. There are some devices and patients with coupons and other things that might just be able to buy them outright. And so you can prescribe them for people without any insurance coverage. And I do think that there is evidence in the literature to support doing that for people not on any insulin. Patients can use a smartphone or a handheld reader from either of the two big companies out there to look at their glucose trends real time. It can alert them for lows in particular so they can respond and make sure that they're protecting themselves from those. Most people, when they get good at this over time, they don't like sticking their finger anymore, and this becomes just easy to wear. Their slim profile, you just forget that you have it on. And so the ease of use is good. And then when you come into the doctor's office, once we get our workflows figured out, I actually think it's so easy to pick through the graphic and make our medical changes. I usually turn my screen to the patient so we can look together at what the line is doing across different days, and we can make a discussion happen. And so this is going to be the future of diabetes care and monitoring glucose. We still have to tell people, don't throw their finger stick glucose monitors out. Don't trash those, because the CGM isn't perfect yet. It has some delay. And if the person's feeling symptoms of low in particular that the CGM's not showing, it might be off, and they should do a finger stick to back up and check what's going on. But those would be all my takeaways.
Fantastic, Jeff. I can't thank you enough for all your time. And you got to thank Juan as well for letting you hang out with us.
I usually, you know, I scare you probably with my late responses to things, that Juan's much better administrator of those things. And I've called her my domestic commander. She's a physician in her own right. But my gosh, I fall off the wheels like a lot of us guys that are married to wonderful gals.
Well, I'm glad I'm friends with both of you. So I still have access to you via her when I need to get in touch.
Definitely, please. Keep me. She'll keep me in line, and I won't, I won't fall apart. It would be good.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox, which include our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback, so please email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com, and it really helps when you subscribe, rate, and review the show on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. A special thanks to our whole Curbsiders team. Our technical production is done by Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto runs our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Krista Chumanchu moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all of that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
And as always, I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.